congratulations on very recently winning the Nobel Prize.
We've been doing this 40 years. There's technical challenges for all of it.
And quantum is such a concentration of compute on many of those challenges.
It's long felt like a scientific moonshot.
But that has changed.
How do I evaluate whether or not this is something I should explore?
The great thing about quantum computing is that there's many ways to build them.
The risk of being too late vastly outweighs the risk of being too early.
There's multiple modalities, and even more modalities keep coming in.
When you solve a useful problem, that will solve a problem and make a company money.
Can you really afford not to have a look?
Welcome to Interconnected, the show from Equinix that explores the hidden infrastructure powering our connected future. Today, we're diving into quantum computing, one of the most transformative frontiers in technology. Once confined to labs, quantum systems are now entering the real world, driving breakthroughs in finance, materials science, and cybersecurity.
But this shift is about more than faster computing. It's about rethinking how we design, how we connect, and how we secure our digital foundations, and how today's infrastructure will evolve for a quantum future.
To unpack it all, we're joined by three guests who are taking quantum from theory to enterprise reality. First up, we're honored to be speaking with Dr. John Martinez, CTO and co-founder of QoLab, who was this year's Nobel Prize winner in physics. His work at Google led to the first demonstration of quantum supremacy, a milestone that made quantum computing real.
And later, we'll talk to Theo Peranon, CEO of Alice and Bob, who's leading efforts to make quantum hardware more scalable and more stable. Joining him is Dr. Mark Jackson, Senior Quantum Evangelist at Quantinium, who helps bridge scientific breakthroughs with enterprise applications. Together, they'll explore how quantum innovation is reshaping the enterprise and the infrastructure behind it.
And so, first of all, John, congratulations on very recently winning the Nobel Prize around your work around quantum tunneling that's basically set up this entire industry. Petrina and I flipped a coin because we were both chomping at the bit to ask you the first question, and Petrina won. So Petrina gets to ask the first question.
So John, quantum computing has long felt like a scientific moonshot, but now we're really starting to see these kind of experiments producing results and early enterprise pilots really starting to emerge. How do you think we should think about this moment? Is it another step in computing evolution, or are we really looking at a fundamental break from everything that came before?
Oh, I think it's more evolutionary. That's the way I look at it. Quantum computing can do extremely powerful computing. And I was fortunate when I was at Google in 2019, where we ran a kind of a mathematical algorithm to show that quantum computer has a power. Google has recently done a paper to show the power in a more practical way, which I think is a big step. But quantum computer can solve only certain kind of problems. You can't take a generic algorithm and speed it up with quantum computer. But I think people have explored this enough to know that there are interesting and useful algorithms. And, you know, people are just trying to build quantum computers to make it more and more powerful, bigger. And people are working at algorithms to try to make them, let's say, more compact. And, you know, the gap between the algorithm and the experiment are closing. And in some cases, they're doing some interesting things. But, you know, clearly we have more work to do. But it's coming along very nicely.
I think what's really interesting there is being able to utilize quantum from an enterprise customer, whether or not you can buy it yourself, rather than being able to use it as a service. So what are your thoughts on some of those enterprise customers now starting to really adopt and test out quantum?
Yeah, I think it's really great that people are building quantum computer systems and put it out there for people to use. That's the right way to do it. Right now, it's still more of a scientific use, maybe some small use cases people are looking at. But, you know, my view is you really have to get it out there and build data farms or servers or whatever you want to think about that so that you can learn how to practically use the quantum computer, learn how to calibrate it and keep it up and running. So I think it's a very, good way to do it. I think this is more going to be a cloud service than you having to buy your own quantum computer and put it in your own data center, although people are doing that modality too, which is good. But You know, in my view, you know, the internet is so powerful these days, unless you have security concerns, you know, it's fine to use a quantum computer remotely. That way we can make sure that the quantum computer that's out there for people to use, it's in your own lab as a company, and then you can make sure it's all up to date and everything is operating properly. It's kind of like most people do their computing with their laptop or their cell phone as a terminal to a data center. I think that's kind of the right model, at least in my view, for most applications. Not all, but most.
Well, John, quantum has moved from theoretical physics into practical engineering. From where you sit, how do you gauge where we really are in this quantum journey? What kind of barriers still stand between us and large-scale commercialization?
Yeah, we've come a long way, and I looked at what we did in 1985. I call these prehistoric qubits because the word hasn't really been invented yet, and people are thinking about quantum computing, although there were some early theory proposals then. It's really around 1990-ish that things got hot in terms of doing that. So we've been doing this 40 years, and we've made tremendous progress among all the different qubit types, and you can begin to see, you know, these real quantum computer systems. But, you know, in the end, what you want to do is build something like a million qubit quantum computer. We're at, you know, 50 or let's say 100 right now, maybe a little bit more in some modalities. But to get up to the million scale is going to take even more work. So I kind of consider from the beginnings to where we are now to be a huge leap in technology. But to get to the millions, you're going to have to do another big leap to get there. But since we know the basic science, we know the basic engineering, our company is going to use semiconductor manufacturing to do that. I think the next step can be faster than what's happened in the past when we're trying to just figure things out.
Yeah, I guess you've talked, John, about like moving from quantum supremacy to quantum utility as that kind of next big leap. Can you unpack those two concepts a little for us and tell us what kind of advances will actually make it possible for quantum systems to operate reliably outside of the lab?
The experiment I was involved in, quantum supremacy at Google in 2019, and even the latest experiment by Google now, has run some special purpose algorithms where you kind of look at a mathematical structure or algorithm, run it on the quantum computer, and show that quantum computer would be faster than if you did it with a classical computer. But these are in specially chosen algorithms. And it's an important step because it shows that you can do something more powerful with a quantum computer. But utility is all about solving practical problems. And initially, I think just solving scientific problems and doing that is really useful. But I think in the end, the real big inflection point is when you solve a useful problem that will solve a problem and make a company money, okay? And then at that point, you can take the profits from that and push it back into building better quantum computers. And then the growth can really accelerate. And I think you saw that when you were looking at, you know, regular computers, electronics industry. From the very beginning, you were starting to, use it for practical applications, and that drove more research. So, clearly we want to make it useful, but at some point when it's useful enough to bring revenue, then I think that's going to really change how the funding is for making the quantum computers better, just like with regular computers.
So before, you said most use cases could be handled by a cloud model. Could you just dive into that a little bit more? Like, what do you mean by most use cases? What use cases wouldn't be? Can you foresee what would work in a cloud type of model versus what a company would need to buy their own?
You know, I would say for me, the way I look at it, the cloud model is really good because you have to, you know, interface with a quantum computer in some way. And you know, the internet is so powerful these days, is that interface can be done remotely or, you know, right next door in the same building. So I would think most cases it could be done remotely, unless, of course, there's security, you know, government security concerns. Fine, I understand that. Now, it is true that people are thinking that you're going to want to have a supercomputer, a classical supercomputer, next to your quantum computer. And in that case, they really should be co-located. But whether that's co-located at your company or remotely, it probably doesn't matter. Although I think when you use a supercomputer, oftentimes you want to have close connection so that you have the bandwidth for getting the data out and doing graphics and other things. But, you know, this goes into the detailed application, and, you know, it's hard for me to predict what you want to do right now.
So for our audience, is it possible for you to actually explain what a qubit is? We talk about these systems, we're going to need a million qubit system, but a lot of people don't understand the concept.
So a qubit is, of course, fashioned after the word bit, where you can have the state of a system being zero or one. But because of quantum mechanics, you can actually build a state where it's both zero and one at the same time, and you have operations. Now, you know, this sounds really kind of strange, but what happens is the laws of quantum mechanics allows you to do that. And the way I like to explain that is just consider the simple hydrogen atom. If it was a classical system, you'd have the nucleus, you'd have the electron, they would, you know, attract each other and stick together, and then atoms would have no size, okay, because the electron is so something strange is going on, and what's strange is quantum mechanics. And basically, the electron can be at all positions around the nucleus at the same time. It gives it size, and it's what quantum mechanics does. And it's something we call putting in the superposition of states. So that's a very fundamental law of the universe that we're taking advantage of. And here what we do is we build a very special quantum system where instead of it can be in all these infinite number of sites, it can be either in the what we call a zero state or one state. There are actually two quantum states. Okay, and in the hydrogen atom, people know about the chemistry that could be, let's say, in the 1s state and the 2s state, okay, would be an example of the two states it could be for a hydrogen atom. So you allow information to be coded that way, and quantum mechanics means that it could be zero and one at the same time. Now, what happens is with quantum mechanics, you can do operations on that zero and one state. Kind of like the Boolean operations that you make a regular computer out, only now you have an, it's a enhanced instruction set, a bigger instruction set to deal with this zero plus one state. So we have an instruction, we call that a pi over two gate that goes from a zero to the zero plus one state. And quantum mechanics allows you to do that definite operation. It actually quantum mechanically operates kind of perfectly, and you definitely know what's, you know, you're in that state. And what being in that superposition to state allows you essentially to build an algorithm where you can compute what happens to zero, you can compute what happens to one for some kind of computation, and you're doing the computation in parallel, okay? So for one qubit, factor of two parallelization, you know, that's not a big deal. But if you have two qubits, there's four possible states, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. And for three, there's eight, and four, there's 16. So the number of states goes as two to the number. So that's exponential. It grows very rapidly. And, you know, by the time we were up to 53 qubits, which was the quantum supremacy experiment at Google, 2 to the 53 is 10 to the 16. And that is so much parallelization that you can then beat a classical supercomputer by taking advantage of that. And of course, you can do way more than 53 qubits in principle. So you can do parallel computation in principle that's, you know, that number is bigger than the number of atoms in the universe, okay? So there's a potential to do that. Now, let me say that the difficulty is, although you get this answer, parallel answer at the end, you have to pull out, okay, what you're interested in. okay, out of these, you know, two of the 16 states, okay? And that's where the difficulty of the algorithm is. You have to devise an algorithm so that when you do a measurement at the end, you can pull out specifically the information you're interested in. And that's what makes algorithms kind of hard to develop and why it's not a universal improvement of all algorithms.
Yeah, I've actually seen one of those simulations that they do with quantum, and you can see everything happening in parallel. And it's actually amazing to watch it. It makes you really understand what quantum computing looks like. In, you know, when we think about quantum computing, a lot of people think, you know, it's just one thing, but actually there's multiple modalities and even more modalities keep coming in. What is the count of modalities that we're at now, and which ones are you most excited about?
Well, okay, so what's funny is if you ask a scientist about this, they will say that their modality is the best, okay? So it's kind of funny to find out about this. But, you know, they're superconducting qubits, which are using superconductors at very low temperatures. And also neutral atoms have come on really strong in the last couple years. And there's an array of atoms that are trapped with laser beams and moved around with laser beams. And that's doing very, very well right now. And I would say also ion traps, they're a little bit like the neutral atoms, only you use electrodes to trap the atoms and move them around. And that has some advantages and disadvantages. Also, there's people who are using photons, photonic quantum computing, which is kind of nice because a lot of the technology is that used for, you know, optical communication, only you have special quantum gadgets to get it to work right. And the other big one is semiconductor spins, where you make your quantum chips in a very similar way that you make CMOS, which is, of course, an advantage for doing that. Now, you know, all those are interesting. I would say that superconducting qubits have the most players and has been a leader in the last, 10 years, 20 years, something like that. I would say the neutral atoms have now come on strong. And it's really interesting time. There's a real competition between the neutral atoms and the superconducting qubits. The neutral atoms can scale up. They're now building traps that are 1,000, 2,000. I mean, you have to see if they're working well, but I think everyone thinks that's going to go well. Superconducting qubits are way faster, but, you know, they're harder to make a lot of them because you have to wire them. So, there's technical challenges for all of it. And it's really an exciting time because there's kind of like a horse race here. And I know journalists kind of like the horse race story. And for me, and doing superconducting qubits, it means we just have to redouble our efforts and, you know, try to solve the scaling problem.
John, I think I'm most excited about the one that has diamonds in it.
Oh, yes, there's the diamond and the spin, that's right. It's good that people are working on all these different ideas, because if you're building something as complex as a computer, it's a very complicated system engineering where you have hundreds of things you have to worry about, and it's usually what's worse that limits you.
So, as quantum theory meets engineering reality, the next big challenge becomes scaling, building the ecosystems and infrastructure that can deliver these capabilities to the business world. So first, Thale, thanks for being with us today. You're building hardware from the ground up. What does it actually take to move quantum systems from the lab environments into scalable enterprise infrastructure?
It's a different thing from running a one-off experiment, writing your Nature paper, from scaling a product and making it, reliable 24/7 on the client's premises or in a remote data center, where you don't control all the environment constraint. So that's the first element. The second one is that when you're running a physics experiment, you're not really concerned about supply chain costs, ease of integration. So it's kind of, purely industrial challenges are really things you tend to overlook when you're in the physics or R&D phase of such a frontier tech program. Whereas when you're entering the stage we're at the moment, which is really scaling the prototypes towards high impact machine, large scale system that can do things that are completely out of reach of the biggest classical supercomputers. When you're in that phase, costs, ease of integration, those are the core challenges you need to tackle. And this is why at the moment we're really transitioning from running a physics lab here in Ballard in Paris to something that resembles more of an industrial plant north of Paris, where we're deploying more than 50 million of capex to scale the technology and our ability to manufacture those devices at scale.
Do your supply chain, your manufacturers already have what they need to help you scale? Are they making new things for you? Or do you have to tap an existing supply chain of products that are already on the shelf?
The really cool thing about the way we're building quantum computers at Alice and Bob using superconducting qubits, those are microwave chips, just like you have in terms of frequencies as 5G or Wi-Fi, I mean, operating in the gigahertz range. But the thing is, people tend to be very impressed by the cryostat, the fridge, you know, that golden chandelier you find on Google Image. But that's actually the easy part of the quantum computer. The tough part is all the classical control electronics we need to control those qubits. And here is exactly where most of the costs of the system, actually up to 85% of the cost of the total system, is the classical electronics parts. And there, it's really about adjacent fields. Actually, when you look under the hood of our control electronics, those are just Xilinx or AMD FPGA boards that we have. So some very standard, really fast electronics that is repurposed for what we're doing. Now the challenge is really about, getting the marginal cost of that control electronic really down. And in some sense, we're close to what you see in the new space industry, where it's all about either integrating vertically the equipment manufacturer or leveraging adjacent industries. And this is exactly what we're doing at the moment.
So, Mark, so coming in there, obviously, Quantinuum has positioned itself as one of the few full-stack players in this space, covering everything from hardware, software, compiler, to algorithm development. How does the integrated approach help you bridge the gap between science and enterprise development?
That's right, Petrina. So at Quantinuum, we have a very unique history because we were the merger between Honeywell Quantum Solutions, which was a quantum hardware team, and Cambridge Quantum Computing, which was a quantum software group. And 4 years ago, almost to the day, they merged. And we now have about 700 people. So we're by far the largest quantum computing group in the world. And the fact that we do everything has had tremendous benefits. So, for example, you might have seen this announcement about Helios, which represents the first commercial quantum computer. So you might describe all the other quantum computers as kind of science projects and that they're interesting, but you can't really do useful things with them. But that has changed. And the fact that we were able to unveil both the hardware itself as well as all these applications. So like concurrently with the announcement of Helios, we had announcements by Amgen or BMW or JP Morgan or SoftBank talking about specific use cases for how they're going to use this to do things. And we even published research articles on superconductivity. And so it's great that we can do kind of everything in-house. And you correctly mentioned, like, we even do our own compilers. So we understand every level of how this works, the compiler, the operating system, the error correction. And so it's great that we can do everything in-house.
So we talk a lot about how quantum systems, in order to get out of just the lab and getting into a commercial enterprise, how they're going to need to connect to classical computing in a big way. Why is the integration of those two concepts essential? And more importantly, how are you approaching that kind of integration in practice?
Yeah, the core thing is that you'll never use a quantum computer to do something as simple as a multiplication or a thing like that. I often say that trying to do so is akin to trying to get better with a lightsaber. It's not just overkill, it's highly inefficient. So that's the kind of concepts you need to have in mind. Actually, you want your quantum computer only to do the the thing that is absolutely unfeasible with the classical computers. But the rest of your pipeline, of your data processing pipeline, is really classical. And so, for example, one foreseen use case I really love to exemplify the need for that sort of, you know, hand-in-hand work between classical and quantum resources is when you think about the future of drug design, where you're going to have classical AI suggesting and trying to guess what would be a nice drug candidate. And then instead of going to your chemists to really test on the wet bench DAP, that AI will call some quantum resources, get an analysis of that molecule, a ground truth, and send back the results to the AI and iteratively work hand in hand to crack that challenge. So it's really about leveraging the best of both worlds in a unified way. The way we're doing so is really being part of a larger ecosystem. And at the moment, we're really excited about NVIDIA's initiative around NVQ Link to bridge the world of classical computing, GPUs, with quantum so that you can program both in and address both in a seamless environment so that you don't have to think twice. It's just going to be completely seamless in the way you design your program or your workflow.
Yeah, that's a really great angle. Mark, when you think about enterprises exploring quantum today, you mentioned a couple of names with your announcement with Elios, BMW said, JP Morgan. What fields do you think, what's going to be the most realistic first wave of applications you see coming online in the next few years? And which industries do you think are going to be most affected?
Yeah, I think it's going to involve chemistry. And the reason for this, and they were certainly correct when you touched on this, is that quantum is only good for very specific things. And one of those things is chemistry. Normal computers have great difficulty in solving the equations that we would need to solve to figure out how a molecule behaves. Quantum is very, very good at it. It's very efficient. And so when you think about how many problems involve chemistry, so that could be like a pharmaceutical company developing a drug, it could be a material science company developing like a fertilizer process, it could be designing a stronger steel, anything involving chemistry, you would need a quantum computer for. And so in the pharmaceutical area, so with a quantum computer, we could do the simulations early on and focus in on the most promising drugs and just do clinical trials of those. And so I think it will revolutionize drug development. It will make what we do now look like medieval times. Yeah.
That's really interesting. I mean, the pharmaceutical use case certainly has the ability to kind of change the world. I see that. I hadn't heard that myself, by the way. That's kind of a revelation to me. So thank you for that. So if you're an enterprise that hasn't really evaluated quantum and how it could help the business, right? So let's say you're looking ahead. How can they know what being quantum ready means to them, right? Is it physical infrastructure? Is it data infrastructure? Is it processes? Is it science? How does an enterprise know that they are a candidate to use quantum systems in combination perhaps with classical and AI stuff in a more intelligent workflow that can solve business problems for them? And this is a question to both of you, by the way. What do you see? If I'm an enterprise, how do I evaluate whether or not this is something I should explore?
The very short answer is that the risk of being too late vastly outweighs the risk of being too early when it comes to quantum. Because it's really about innovation arbitrage. In the sense that for many industries, quantum will enable a whole new wave of innovations, which will come with IP redistribution, novel patents for all those industries. And so you can't really wait and see how it's going to play out because you might be completely locked out. So for example, let's take one industry. You're working in automotive. Here you have two main material science. The first one, how you get rid of rare earths for your magnets, for your motors. And the second one is how do you design better, cheaper, easier to recycle batteries. As soon as you get a few hundreds of sufficiently good logical qubits, then you might be able to crack all those challenges. So this might completely reshuffle the cards of that whole vertical. So the main advice I would give to corporates is really, can you really afford not to have a look? And if so, it just takes, you know, a few experts internally to steer use cases, try a few proof of concepts, will cost you a handful of millions to get started. But then you'll have a clear strategic view of the potential impact.
Yeah, I mean, that's a heck of a tagline. Quantum, you have to take a look, right? Okay, so Mark, how about you?
Yeah, I still encounter people that tell me, I'm monitoring Quantum, but I'm waiting till it actually gets here before I do anything about it. And I just want to shake them and tell them, no, it's already here. You should start now. Do not wait any longer. So what I would recommend is starting like a quantum readiness team. Assemble people in your organization to focus on exactly this. Work with quantum experts. Work with people who are familiar with the field and understand how quantum is going to affect your industry. Work on some sort of proof of concept project. Even at a lower budget, you could still familiarize yourself with quantum. And if nothing else, upgrade your encryption to post-quantum encryption. So there's all these things that need to be done immediately if you want to survive because of quantum computing.
Yeah, and I guess with all this noise around sort of AI at the moment and all about power consumption, what are your thoughts around quantum and sustainability or clean energy? Is there an angle there for people to consider quantum more?
So the good news is that quantum by its nature is very energy efficient. In fact, I believe our new Helios machine, it uses the power equivalent of 17 hair dryers. In fact, in our benchmarking algorithm, we compare the benchmarking calculation that we did to the equivalent power that it would take if we did it with normal computers. And I believe it was all the power produced by all the stars that you see in the sky. So it's incomparably more energy efficient, yes. That kind of mitigates climate change and power consumption, but it doesn't reverse it. But we're already starting to use quantum computing to do things like carbon capture. So we have a project with Metal Organic Frameworks to extract CO2 from the environment. And you might have seen the Nobel Prize in chemistry this year was given for MOFs. So we're actually starting to tackle this chemistry problem using quantum computing to actually try to reverse things like climate change.
So maybe that's the angle, right? As for people to really kind of shift their interest and focus more onto quantum. Theo, what are your thoughts around that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, on the climate impact, I can only agree with what Mark just said. Now, one thing that is becoming clearer and clearer in this AI wave is how critical computing infrastructure is becoming to businesses. It's no longer, you know, just one services among others. The 20th century was all about how does industrial players access abundant and cheap energy. Now, I firmly believe the 21st century will be all about how you access abundant and cheap compute. And quantum is such a concentration of compute for many of those challenges. It's really critical to start thinking about how you're going to secure your access to abundant quantum infrastructure. And you can do so with a light hearted because you know you won't have such a negative impact on the planet by consuming quantum, given everything Mark just said.
And so just one sort of question for me that I've been dying to ask you. Do you think that there'll be one quantum provider that will reign all? Or do you actually think that there will be different quantum use cases for different quantum modalities?
I'd love to answer that it's going to be a diverse and that would be so much more beautiful. But in my personal opinion, the history of compute tells us that for each generation, it's almost always quasi-monopoly because of the virtuous cycle of and how liquid compute is. So it might sort out to just a handful of players. Now, I'm not sure it's going to happen before 2030-ish. So you still have time to experiment with different modalities and support your favorite.
I actually think many modalities will win. The great thing about quantum computing is that there's many ways to build them and there's many approaches and you've heard about two of them today. But there's maybe like five or six kind of mainstream approaches. Each have advantages and disadvantages. And so the ion trap approach we use, it's very promising for the next few years. We have a very aggressive roadmap, which has already been proven. But this is one reason why we are full stack. We have software which works on any quantum computer. Maybe someone will come up with like a hybrid approach where you get the best of both worlds. I don't know. And as you said, maybe it will depend on the use case that you're considering. But I think it's semi-miraculous we have any way of building a quantum computer. I think it's even more wonderful that we have many ways of building them.
A huge thank you to our guests for helping us understand what it will take to move quantum computing from lab experiments to enterprise scale reality.
And thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for our next episode where we'll explore another megatrend shaping the digital world. You can find Interconnected on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts.